different feeling, I guess, to be sitting here in person. It certainly is for me. It just has a different and more positive feeling, I think, post-lockdown. And the title of this reflection is Dharma Gates, or the Secular as Sacred. So as most of you know, I've experienced some significant changes in the circumstances of the way we live at home, and I've become pretty much a full-time carer for my wife, which entails a whole lot of new challenges, and of course, with the challenges, a whole lot of opportunities for practice. And this reflection is a little bit of a follow-on from what Anya talked about last time, in which she considered the concepts of the sacred and the ordinary, and the bridge between them, or almost the overlap, or in terms perhaps of today's sutra reading, the relative and the absolute, the equation of those two things. So my starting point is something that's been bugging me for a while. I had a little bit of a chat with Jeff Dawson about it, and also then found out that Robert Aitken also was bugged by it. And that's the translation of the great vows that we recite every time that we sit down. And we say that dharmas are countless, and I vow to wake to them. So that's my vow. Now, the text is very, very specific on that. It's got an extra word in there which hasn't been translated, and that's gates. Dharma gates are countless, and I vow. And then it gets a little bit complicated again. I vow to study them, or I vow to learn them in the original Chinese and Japanese. And I wasn't completely surprised when I stumbled across Robert Aitken Roshi's, he had an article in Tricycle magazine just about that problem. The Diamond Sangha had moved to, or had used the translation that we've adopted, dharmas are countless, without the gates in it at first. And he talks a little bit about the history of why that was, and that the group had a long discussion about translations. I think Stephen Mitchell, who's a very noted translator of all sorts of sacred texts, had made some suggestions, and they ended up with what we say, dharmas are countless, I vow to wake to them. But then, as he says in his article, we omitted the troublesome gates. But in our new version, we have reinstated the gates because they really are Dharma openings, our chances for realization of the myriad things that advance and confirm us when we are open to them. So they went back at some point to the fuller translation of the gates. But that also entails a little bit of a problem, as he then goes on to point out. And then if the verb, instead of I vow to wake to them, is the literal translation is study or learn, can you study or learn a gate? These are the perplexities of translation. And I have a gut feeling that, and there's no substantiation for that, that there were these huge translation projects at various times in Tang China in the 7th century and afterwards. And I wonder if there wasn't actually a mistake at some point, because we do find things like that. But that's got no grounding in scholarship. So we're stuck with the problem of having gates and then study or learning them. And I have a suggestion to make about that, and that's that, well, we use the verb investigate. I vow to investigate them. So Dharma gates are countless. So many opportunities to work with the Dharma, to investigate them. And that's what I'm finding in my life. It's throwing up something. Okay, what do I do with this? So I want to investigate that. But investigation involves practice and something active as much, not just Sherlock Holmes with his magnifying glass or something like that to forensically examine something, but to actually put it into practice. So I would suggest something like Dharma Gates Are Countless, I Vow to Investigate Them. Now, another kind of troublesome term is Dharma itself. And to quote from the Princeton Dictionary of Buddhism, it says, Dharma is notoriously difficult to translate. So we're embarking on a notorious adventure here. And clearly, I think there are at least two major dichotomies. One, and often we see Dharma with a capital D as opposed to a small d, and that is an attempt, I think, to make one important distinction. So that Dharma with a capital D might be translated as something like a teaching or doctrine, the way in a sense. It's very interesting in Chinese and Japanese. It puzzled me at first, the literal translation is the law. This is the way things are. This is the explanation of reality, I think. So Dharma with a capital D, but this is Dharma with a small d. And there are several ways of looking at that, but basically I can refer to physical or mental phenomenon or individual building blocks of our existence. Jeff has suggested that it can be the circumstances of this moment being present just for this moment. What does that present? That's the Dharma. That's something we can investigate and practice, therefore. Anya talked a little bit about the term sacred and how that is overlaid with all sorts of meanings for people in established religions, and sometimes can be feel a bit awkward for those of us who are not believers of those major established religions, which make a distinction between the worldly, the secular, and the sacred as something spiritual, something non-worldly. Somehow remember St. Augustine in the city of God and the city of man or something like that, making these distinctions. Now, this is not something that we do in Zen or in Buddhism. And actually, the title of a book that I used to use when I was still teaching Chinese history and Chinese thought, a really interesting book, was just called The Secular as Sacred. It was talking about Confucianism in that sense, saying Confucianism has got lots of rituals in it, and sometimes that's seen as just a burdensome, you know, it's all form. And the author was suggesting that what it's really doing is taking everyday things and what elevating them or equating them with the sacred. So that seems to me pretty much in harmony with our understanding, our practice of Zen as well. So that we're not making a distinction between secular and sacred, or as the sutra we're reading this morning, between the relative and the absolute, that might be another way of looking at it. So the implication of that is, it seems to me, is that everyday life can be viewed as a sacred enterprise. There are infinite opportunities for elevating or equating everyday things, everyday dharmas with the sacred. And again, Anya gave an example last talk about Thich Nhat Hanh washing the dishes. And that's a perfect kind of thing. What a sacred act washing the dishes are, you know. And then we can extend that to brushing our teeth or greeting people or, you know, anything. Driving with people now, getting very traffic picking up again after that was one of the best things about our lockdown, was being able to drive on relatively car-free roads. So the problem then is to be, at least for me, is very much to be in the moment and recognize and to be able to acknowledge the countless dharmas that present. And in my new role as a carer in particular, I find that sometimes hard to hard to do. I got so caught up in what needs to be done and the doing of it and the difficulty of the doing of it that I lose sight of the fact this is actually an opportunity for practice. It's a Dharma gate opening right in front of me. All I have to do is open it. Easier said than done. That's all I have to do. So there are various ways of doing this. The one that I use, I try to practice when I'm in the present moment enough to realize that a Dharma gate is opening, and not to push against them, to turn the latch and let myself through, is an exercise that I learned with mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's called STOP, S-T-O-P, which many people probably have heard of. And S stands for stop, whatever it is you're doing. T for take a breath. O for observe what's going on internally and externally, but especially internally. So observe. And P, MBSR talks about proceed. I've adopted practice instead of that, which also fits. So what is my practice now that I've been able to halt the ever-churning mind and to do whatever it is? So the practice might be making dinner, the practice might be providing some sort of physical help. There are other ones that some people use RAIN, R-A-I-N. I find that a little bit too benign for me. I want to stop, and things are, you know, it's the merry-go-round, right? Oh, I want to get off at this point, and I want to open that Dharma gate and investigate what it's asking me to do. And of course, another concept or practice that I find very helpful, especially in this new role where I don't know from day to day how the day is going to proceed, or even hour to hour, sometimes minute to minute. There seem to be abrupt changes in the Dharma gate that's presenting itself, is of course the idea of beginner's mind. If I can, if I wasn't sure I could get here this morning, because yesterday was a very busy day early in the morning. Today was not a very busy day in the morning. Here I am, the gate opened. But there was another gate. The other gate was, it's a busy morning and I've got to attend to whatever is behind that gate. So that I'm learning that even though a lot of planning is important in terms of overall the general dynamic of our lives, that from minute to minute, the plans may not, what I thought I could do in 5 minutes' time may not be practical. And to be able to let go of that and to investigate, again, to open that Dharma gate and say, well, what is it saying to me? It's saying that I can't prepare this meal right at the moment. There's something else to do with whatever it is. So stop may help me get there and say, hey, there's a gate in front of you. It's asking to be open, to investigate what's behind that gate and to treat it as something entirely new, to let go of the assumptions and say, this is something that I approach as a beginner. In a sense, every moment, every Dharma opening can be approached as a beginner. We never know what's going to happen if we're in the moment.